I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wear a mask. Stay safe.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun.
This is KBOO Portland, listener powered non corporate community radio.
Many people ask me what my show, Radio Lost and Found, is about, and I tell them it's about 1 hour 58 minutes. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media scape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more, coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the governor issues a statewide mask mandate. Portland leads the country in murder rates of black citizens. And in national news, Congress passes a $3.5 trillion budget blueprint. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 11th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. The governor's office ordered a new indoor mask mandate to go into effect on Friday. All Oregonians age 5 or older will be required to wear masks indoors regardless of vaccination status. Kate Brown had been reticent to reinstate a statewide mandate, deferring that decision to the counties. But when cases unexpectedly spiked with the rise of the Delta variant, only Multnomah County took action. Here's some of what the governor had to say today.
Let me start with the numbers because they are shocking. Yesterday, we had over 2,300 cases reported, the highest number since the virus first landed in Oregon. Hospitalizations are also at a record high. Across the state, our ICU beds are about 90% filled. Some of our hospital regions have fewer than 5 ICU beds available to start the day. These numbers are because of the Delta variant. These numbers are despite the fact that nearly 73% of Oregon's adults are vaccinated. The harsh reality is that Delta is a different virus. It has changed everything. Modeling from the Oregon Health Authority and Oregon Health and Science University project that without new safety interventions, COVID-19 hospitalizations will completely overwhelm our doctors and nurses in the coming weeks. Without safety measures, we could be as many as 500 staffed hospital beds short of what we need to treat patients by September. And that's patients coming into the hospital for any reason, COVID, a heart attack, or a car accident. When hospitals run out of beds, we are all at risk. Our families are at risk. Throughout the pandemic, we have learned that quick and decisive action saves lives. Vaccines are the best way to protect yourself and your family from this deadly virus. We continue to work to reach Oregonians with information and a vaccine. but it's clear the current situation requires immediate action to stop the Delta variant from spreading further. That's why, moving forward for the immediate future, masks will be required in all indoor public settings, effective this Friday, August 13th. The latest science is clear that both vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals are able to spread the Delta variant. Masks are simple and they are effective. Wearing a mask should give you confidence that you are not infecting others. Masks are also our best bet at keeping our schools and our businesses open. I know Oregonians are tired of wearing masks. I certainly am too. But every time someone wears a mask, that's one more unvaccinated kid we're protecting.
That was Oregon Governor Kate Brown announcing the statewide indoor mask mandate that starts Friday. Governor Kate Brown declared a state of emergency yesterday ahead of this week's heat wave. The order unlocks access to emergency resources and lasts through August 20. Multnomah County and the Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler also declared local states of emergency to go into effect today. Last month's record-breaking temperatures led to nearly 200 deaths in Oregon and Washington. Most of Oregon's deaths were in Multnomah County. 20% of those who died lived in mobile homes. Six deaths occurred in properties belonging to Home Forward, Portland's housing authority. Cooling centers have been set up in Portland at Arbor Lodge Shelter, Sunrise Center, the Charles Jordan Community Center, and the Portland Building. Beaverton City Libraries are open during the day for cooling. Tigard Public Library and Tigard Senior Center will be also available during the day. TriMet has offered free transportation to cooling centers. During the previous heat wave, Portland's light rail ceased operating due to the high temperatures. Many Portland residences lack air conditioning. Residents are recommended to check in with elderly neighbors and others who may be particularly vulnerable to heat-related illnesses. In the past 12 months, 94 Portlanders were murdered. 39 of them were Black. That's despite African Americans constituting less than 6% of the city's population. Last year's violence puts Portland ahead of Chicago and Philadelphia for murder rates of Black residents, and almost double that rate of Los Angeles. Black city officials Rich Chapman, Mingus Maps, and Andre Miller have each spoken urging for long-term solutions. Officials partially attributed the rising murder rate to displacement due to gentrification, poor gun legislation, and the lack of city resources. After an acrimonious debate, the Newburgh School Board passed a controversial measure to ban Black Lives Matter and pride flags in public schools. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The Newburgh School Board voted yesterday to ban Black Lives Matter and pride flags. The 4-3 vote enacts a prohibition on those flags and any broadly political signs or clothing. The board's policy committee has not yet defined what qualifies as political. Board Chair David Brown justified his vote, claiming that the board makes decisions for every single student at the high school, and not just children represented in one group. He also claimed some students might be negatively impacted by these flags without elaborating. Board Vice Chair Brian Shannon said the main goal was to get political and divisive symbols out of school, to focus on educating students. New leaders on the board appear to be moving the district in a different, more conservative direction. In a contentious July meeting, the board also discussed repealing the school district's anti-racist policies. This follows the national trend of increasingly politicized school boards, which some have attributed to live stream board meetings during the COVID pandemic. School district staff members signed a letter asking the board to vote no on the flag ban. Some shared stories of Black and queer students facing harassment at school or abuse at home. Teacher Stacy Dalton said pride and Black Lives Matter flags are messages of love and support. The Oregon School Board Members of Color Caucus also sent a letter to the Newburgh School Board voicing their concern. They claimed the board's actions run contrary to state and federal law and urged them to consider their impact on the community. A motion to postpone the vote to allow for more feedback from students failed. Newburgh Superintendent Joe Morlock said he will check with district lawyers before putting the motion into place. It won't be enforceable until it has undergone legal review. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Collisions between cars and mule deer are common in the Malheur River Canyon, especially along Highway 20. These accidents are both expensive and threaten the mule deer population. The Burns Paiute tribe is taking steps to buck the trend. Eric Tagetoff has more on the story.
Eastern Oregonians are calling for a solution to wildlife collisions along a stretch of highway through the Malheur River Canyon, and the Burns Paiute tribe is leading the effort. Vehicle crashes with mule deer on a windy part of Highway 20 is estimated to cost more than $1 million a year. Harney County Commissioner Kristen Shellman describes the section of road.
It's a very dangerous situation. There's many tight corners, and they come out of nowhere. You really have no time or warning to see the deer and to try to stop.
The Burns Paiute tribe collared and collected data on mule deer between 2010 and 2013 and has identified the biggest problem spots. Mule deer populations have declined as much as 40% in the Malheur Canyon area in recent years. Burns Paiute Tribe Council Chair Jody Richards says it's important for people to make it safely through this stretch of highway. She also notes that mule deer are important to the tribe, and not only for the meat they provide.
The hide, we still make moccasins. People still tan the hides. They still make gloves. They use the antlers for digging. There's all different kinds of things we use that whole animal for, so it's very important to the tribe and the people here.
Shellman points to the benefits of wildlife crossings installed on another highway in Central Oregon, which reduced collisions there by 86%.
One of the solutions that is being discussed is something similar to what Highway 97 has undergone with trying to put in some access points for the deer to go under the road.
Funding is the biggest barrier. Shellman says they hope to find money from different sources. One could be the federal transportation bill, which Congress is working to reauthorize. It will likely include dedicated funding for wildlife crossings for the first time ever. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Texas Republicans voted to authorize the arrests of dozens of Democratic representatives. Those Democrats left the state a month ago to prevent the passage of a sweeping attack on voting rights. The vote came just hours after Texas's all-Republican Supreme Court overruled a lower court decision forbidding the arrests. The Texas legislature is just four votes short of the quorum it needs to pass the voting restrictions. Democratic State Rep. Gina Hinojosa asked her colleagues not to return to the State House. She specifically called out Democrats who had returned to Texas and accused them of, quote, throwing us under the bus. Republicans justify their bill as a bulwark for election integrity, but there is no credible evidence of significant voter fraud anywhere in the country. Texas Senator Ted Cruz blocked an attempt in Washington today to pass comprehensive federal voting rights legislation. A single Texas Republican, Lyle Larson, publicly dissented with his colleagues, tweeting, quote, "Civil discourse took a nasty turn today." Portland News poet Dan Raphael is tired of reruns in the news and thinks we should refocus our energies against existential threats. In his own words, here's Dan Raphael with Poe Justice.
The heat comes back, COVID unmasking come back, another season of wildfires, two steps forward, two steps back. Sometimes the best defense is a strong offense against COVID, against fascism, against climate breakdown. The IPCC reports us things are desperate but not impossible. But how can solutions happen when the governments we need to lead us are controlled by billionaires planning to ride out planetary chaos in bunkers on private islands or escaping into space? Let's bring back something very few of us were here for, the focus our country had in World War II, where the enemy is our own blindness to the consequences of our actions, and those doing the most damage take the lead and responsibility. Maybe this united purpose will cut down gun violence, violence against those different than us, showing we're all connected, all necessary to mutual survival. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our in-depth interview with Dr. Sheila Vakaria about the disparate impacts that drug testing has in communities. Then at 5:45, it's news from the Boo. your look at the news inside KBOO with our co-interim station manager, Jenna Yokoyama. At 7 tonight is Hard Knock Radio, a daily hip-hop talk show. Tonight's weather is hotter than you'd like it to be in the 80s and 90s. An excessive heat warning is in effect until 10 p.m. Tomorrow will be even hotter. Prepare for 105 degrees by the late afternoon and 22% humidity with very little wind. On August 11th, 3114 BCE, the Mayan long count calendar started. According to Maya religion, this marks the creation of the world. The quote today is from Jim Morrison. The future is uncertain, but the end is always near. Last December, an unarmed black man named Andre Hill was shot and killed by a police officer in Columbus, Ohio. Officer Adam Coy had neglected to turn on his body camera prior to the incident. 8 months later, Ohio lawmakers consider a new bill clarifying procedures for body camera use. Some law enforcement officers disagree with its current form. Mary Sherman has more on the story.
Body cameras would be required for all police officers in Ohio under new legislation. Columbus Representative Dontavius Jarls says he introduced House Bill 367 to honor Andre Hill, a 47-year-old black man who was killed by an officer who failed to turn on his body camera.
We wanted to make sure that we created an opportunity to provide transparency when a loved one is killed by a law enforcement officer.
Jarls says the legislation will create proactive procedures to clarify body camera use. But Sydney Police Chief William Balling is concerned about parts of the bill, including a 21-day mandate to release unedited body cam footage.
An unedited version may have private-sensitive information on it from an individual that we're not allowed to release for public record law, and that's for their protection. We're supposed to black that out.
The bill requires all law enforcement agencies to provide body-worn cameras for each officer and correctional officer by July 1st, 2023. Those agencies can apply to the state attorney general for funds to purchase body cameras. Balling argues the bill has financial shortcomings. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine allocated a $10 million grant in February to provide agencies with body cameras. But according to Balling, it isn't enough.
My officers had body cameras for the last 4 to 5 years. We love them. But there's a huge cost to maintaining a body camera program. And who's going to pay for all the body cameras for places that don't have it? You have to look beyond the surface sometimes to get the answers. And I'm afraid this is a surface bill.
While the bill doesn't detail how state money will cover body camera equipment to reach the 2023 deadline, Jarls says he wants to move it through the General Assembly now and address the funding issue later.
The hope is that timeline will spur conversation as to how do we begin to really move our entire state forward to making sure that all police officers, all law enforcement officers have a body camera, and we have the system capable of supporting those officers and the data.
HB 367 will be assigned to a committee in September when the General Assembly returns to session. This story was produced with original reporting from Troy Pearson at Kent State University. I'm Mary Sherman. Support for this reporting was provided by Meeting the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
The head of the Oxford Vaccine Group says herd immunity to coronavirus is no longer possible. Dr. Andrew Pollard addressed the UK Parliament Tuesday. His reasoning is that the Delta variant can infect the vaccinated and those previously infected with COVID-19. Pollard predicts that anyone who is unvaccinated at this point will eventually become infected with the virus. Pollard also questioned the health secretary's plans to roll out booster vaccines next month. Pollard said, quote, "The time we would need to boost is if we see evidence that there was an increase in hospitalization among those who are vaccinated. And that is not something we are seeing at the moment." End quote. This morning, the U.S. Senate approved a $3.5 trillion budget blueprint on a party-line vote. This budget is separate from the bipartisan trillion-dollar infrastructure plan that passed yesterday. This is a key step towards the passage of a comprehensive legislation which includes expanding Medicare, establishing paid family and medical leave, and investing in green energy. Before the vote, senators offered many non-binding amendments to the resolution. Republican amendments, including denouncing tax hikes on the wealthy, supporting a ban on the teaching of quote-unquote critical race theory, and pushing a $50 billion increase to the Pentagon budget. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden proposed an amendment for tax increases on the nation's richest 0.1%, but three Democratic senators joined Republicans in voting it down. The $3.5 trillion budget resolution now heads to the House, which can either pass the measure as is or amend it and send it back to the Senate. House Democrat Majority Leader Steny Hoyer announced yesterday that the chamber will cut its recess short to take up the measure on August 23rd. Once the House passes the budget framework, congressional committees will convert the blueprint into legislative text, which could take around a month. The budget package will be exempt from filibuster in the Senate, but will require all Democratic senators to vote for it to pass. Democratic Senators Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin have expressed reservations about the size of the budget. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reported that unless drastic measures are taken to reduce CO2 emissions, the planet will face runaway climate change. With more on that story and others, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Accumulation of greenhouse gases is going up and up faster over time. Response in terms of, say, temperature is going up essentially proportionately. And things like sea level rise are also going up faster and faster.
Mark Howden, vice chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, talked about the group's new report, which warns the Earth could face runaway global temperature changes unless drastic efforts are made to reduce greenhouse gases. Scientists concluded average global temperatures will likely rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2040, based on carbon emissions already in the atmosphere. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress Monday to pass a bipartisan resolution to raise the amount of money the U.S. government can borrow, saying failing to increase the debt ceiling would cause irreparable harm to the economy. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell warned Republicans won't help.
Democrats have all the existing tools they need to raise the debt limit on a partisan basis. If they want 50 lockstep Democratic votes to spend trillions and trillions more, they can find 50 Democratic votes.
Meanwhile, Democrats released their $3.5 trillion budget resolution Monday as they prepared to pass the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. The chamber will approve the infrastructure plan as soon as today. Florida Senator Rick Scott.
The reckless Democrat spending is causing inflation. I mean, look all around the country. Gas prices are up a buck, food prices are up, car prices are up, home prices are up.
Melissa DeRosa, the top aide to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, has resigned as state lawmakers continue to call on the governor to step down. Speaker of the New York State Assembly, Carl Hastie.
The governor's clearly lost the confidence of the majority members of the New York State Assembly. The Attorney General's report lays out in painful detail the many instances and ways in which he reportedly harassed and created a hostile work environment.
A widely criticized Republican-led review of the 2020 general election in Arizona appears to be nearing the finish line. The Maricopa County probe, ordered by GOP state senators, has lasted weeks longer than anticipated. Now the company leading the review, Cyber Ninjas, a Florida-based cybersecurity firm with no prior experience in elections, says it's preparing a final report on its findings. Finally, Philip Morris International has raised its bid against global private equity fund Carlyle Group to acquire Vectura, a UK-based drug manufacturer specializing in inhaled medicines, to $1.4 billion. Experts say the big tobacco company is remaking its image as it invests in cigarette alternatives and treatments for respiratory illnesses. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Congress's $1 trillion infrastructure bill includes over $11 billion for Native and tribal communities. Access to fresh water and electricity remains scarce in some reservation lands. With that story and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause in for Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Senate passed a bipartisan bill that includes more than $11 billion in infrastructure funding for tribes and Native communities. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act includes billions of dollars for sanitation construction, a tribal transportation program, approved water rights settlements, and a broadband connectivity program. Hawaii's U.S. Senator Brian Schatz chairs the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs and spoke in favor of the bill.
This legislation contains more than $11 billion in direct
investments for Native communities, including $3.5 billion for clean water access and delivery, $3 billion for safe roads and bridges, $2 billion to close the digital divide for American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian families.
The bill moves to the U.S. House for further consideration. The U.S. military will review whether some awards to Black and Native American veterans should be upgraded to the Medal of Honor. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin wrote in an August 2nd memo that the review will cover Black and Native American veterans of the Korean and Vietnam Wars, as well as Native Americans who fought in World War II. The Army and Navy conducted similar reviews for Black World War II veterans. The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat. In a release, the Defense Department said that the review will make sure that veterans who served at a time of widespread racial discrimination receive equal opportunities for their valor to be recognized. An agreement between the Picayune Rancheria of Chukchansi Indians and Madera County, California, will expand sheriff and fire services to Chukchansi tribal land and the nearby community. Claudia Gonzalez is the chairwoman for the Picayune Rancheria.
Picayune has a long history of working with Madera County and their board of supervisors. The tribe and the county have always stressed the importance of working together to protect and serve our local community as a whole.
According to a news release, the tribe will increase funding to a local fire station to increase staffing and to better use a fire truck.
And just being able to provide the assistance and the knowledge and being able to protect our community was a huge thing for the tribe to make sure everyone was safe.
The agreement will also reimburse the county sheriff's office for patrolling the tribe's casino and provide funding for two patrol vehicles at the casino. A federal district court in Washington vacated a past ruling in a decades-long fishing rights dispute between the Lummi Nation and two Tsleil-Waututh tribes. The Tsleil-Waututh tribes claimed the Lummi Nation had encroached on their territorial waters in northwest Washington. The district court had ruled in a previous judgment that the Lummi Nation didn't include the waters in question. However, the Ninth Circuit made a decision in another judgment in June that the Lummi Nation wasn't encroaching on the other tribes' waters. The Tsleil-Waututh tribes contested that decision, and now the federal district court's decision to vacate its past ruling also favors the Lummi Nation. U.S. District Judge Ricardo Martinez urged the tribes to work together on a potential resolution, saying, quote, "Ultimately, there may not be a legal solution, and if there is, it will likely have to come from the Ninth Circuit," end quote. A California State Commission will launch an investigation into the treatment of a sacred site on a university campus. Located on what is now the California State University Long Beach, Pavunga is an ancient and sacred village site that holds historical and cultural significance to the Tongva, the Hoshimen, and other Southern California tribes. In 2019, the university dumped construction dirt and debris from a student housing project on the 22-acre site. Tribal groups protested and sued, alleging that in doing so, the university desecrated the site. On July 30th, the California Native American Heritage Commission unanimously voted to launch the investigation. The commission will also file an amicus brief in support of tribal groups in the ongoing lawsuit. For National Native News, I'm Tripp Krause.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 11th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Dan Raphael. The producer is Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Tripp Krause, Anthony Lizowitz, Nadia Romlagan, Mary Sherman, Mark Richardson, and Eric Tagadoff. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We're taking a look at the disparate impacts that drug testing has on communities.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
To start, would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Dr. Sheila Vakaria, Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance.
Awesome. So the 2021 Olympics are going on in Tokyo, and there are a lot of obviously fantastic athletes competing, but there are some that we didn't get to see. In the U.S., sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson was barred from competing after a drug test showed she had consumed marijuana while here in Oregon, where it is a legal substance. So it's an interesting time to talk about drug testing. Obviously, you work with the Drug Policy Alliance, which recently launched a new initiative called Uprooting the Drug War. So we want to consider these things, how drug testing fits in, you know, to that initiative. So maybe to start out with a little bit of primer, what does a drug test look like and when is it employed?
So there are several different kinds of drug tests that people might be familiar with. So the most common one that we see in a lot of settings is one that's a urine drug test. So basically you pee in a cup and someone has a dipstick of several panels. It kind of looks like one of those pregnancy tests. And you basically dip it in, and if you see certain bars or lines activated across it, it'll tell you if there are metabolites that show up positive or negative for different drugs. And, you know, for depending on the drug and the drug type, you know, a drug can show up 24 to 48 hours of use. But also with a drug like marijuana, you could have used it days or weeks ago, and that's the kind of drug that actually stays in your system longer. You can test positive even if you haven't used it within the past day or two.
And what kind of settings are drug tests employed in?
In a lot of settings. So some of us might have had to take a drug test for the current job that we work in. It's very common in private sector jobs in a variety of kinds of situations, but it's also a required part of federal workplaces. And oftentimes, a drug test is kind of among the first things that you do. You know, after you go through your interview, you go and get a job offer. The drug test might be the thing that's between after getting your offer and determining what your first day is. And so a lot of us have it within the context of these kinds of jobs that we seek out, but people can also get drug tested for certain kinds of benefits that they might apply for with the federal government. Depending on the state that you live in, if you're applying for benefits that help with food or financial or cash assistance, you may be required to show up somewhere and be subjected to a urine drug test. And depending on those results, you may be mandated to treatment or may have to do something to prove that you're not actually using drugs so that you can get those benefits.
Wow. So there's definitely, you know, a variety of settings where that's employed. Definitely. I keep saying employed, and obviously employment plays in here. I'm going to try to stop doing that because it's a little bit cliche. But so there's a variety of different, you know, settings where this kind of thing is important and is used and is critical, a critical sort of impasse. And the status quo, you know, sort of method of thinking would say that it's helpful, but we have to ask who bears the burden of drug testing. Does it have disparate impacts?
Absolutely. You know, one setting in which I failed to mention where drug tests are used is also during the point of pregnancy. So for some people who are pregnant, they are subjected to frequent, blood draws and urine tests to check sugar levels, hormone levels, vitamin levels, et cetera. But depending on where you live, you may also be subjected, knowingly or unknowingly, to a urine drug test during the course of a pregnancy or upon the delivery of your child. One of the things that we know is that urine drug testing or any sort of drug testing is disproportionately used against Black and brown parents and pregnant people when compared to white people. And, you know, the results of these tests can lead to the involvement of Child Protective Services in a state because many Child Protective Service organizations identify drug use, recent drug use by a parent as a form of abuse or neglect. Whether or not the child or the fetus has been born yet, or whether or not there has actually been any evidence of abuse or neglect. Sometimes the simple act of using a drug and testing positive for it is seen as sign enough that there could be a problem in the home and that child welfare services need to get involved.
You mentioned sort of the racial component of drug testing. Can you speak more about that?
Yeah. You know, whereas, you know, average, you know, studies of, everyday Americans and folks in the U.S. kind of estimate that there are comparable rates of drug use among all racial groups. We kind of use in the same, we're all equally as likely to use drugs. What we do know is that not all of us are equally likely to be tested for drugs or to be seen as suspected drug users. Despite the fact that we know that all groups use drugs at similar rates, we find that people in positions of power who can subject someone to drug testing often are more likely to subject people of color, Black people specifically, to drug testing to uncover their drug use because they somehow suspect they may be more likely to have recently used a drug. And the consequences of this can be pretty severe. You know, as I said to you before, it can involve job loss, it can involve child custody cases and hearings and the involvement of the state and whether or not you can continue to be a parent to your child. And it can involve the state in deciding whether or not you deserve access to various benefits that can help you and your family get on your feet if you need support.
And so the Drug Policy Alliance's initiative, Uprooting the Drug War, says that there's a dubious benefit that the public receives from the practice of drug testing. So talk me through some of that. What are the public benefits of drug testing, if there are any, and why should we question them?
So a lot of proponents of drug testing say that we need to drug test people before they apply for jobs because we don't want people with addictions or drug habits to get a job at our agency or organization and then end up being unreliable or causing problems in the workplace or engaging in high-risk behaviors in the workplace. So a lot of the arguments for drug testing are to, you know, so-called make these public safety or these employee safety or workplace safety arguments, or to detect whether an employee is going to be a reliable or good employee. And the problem is that when we make that kind of framing, like, why do we need to use a gotcha, like a drug test, rather than taking someone at their word at the point of the job interview about whether or not they use drugs or whether or not they would be impaired in the workplace, right? Because as I said to you before, a drug test, especially a urine drug test, is not going to actually tell you your current impairment. It's just going to say whether you have a metabolite for a drug that you might have used within the past couple days, or as I said with the case of marijuana, within the past days or weeks. So really, it's a gotcha because it catches whether you used recently, but it doesn't even necessarily say whether you used and are currently under the influence right now, that it's impairing your judgment or your ability to be a reliable employee or your ability to do your job. And so, you know, these arguments that it catches people doesn't really support the idea that a lot of people actually have, that, you know, if people do have drug problems, if they do have an addiction, it's a health issue that they probably need help for. And, you know, you can honestly find ways to increase access to services and make referrals or tell people about the, you know, the options for getting treatment or help in their communities if they need that. But the presumption that at the point of employment, we need to determine this right away without really actually getting to know a person, I think it just perpetuates more stigma. And, you know, this idea that we need to drug test people for public benefits is also a way to screen out people who may actually have drug problems or addictions and need help from getting the food support or the cash assistance they need to get themselves on their feet so that they can achieve recovery or they can achieve their goals or they can make sure to have a full stomach so that they can focus on, you know, potentially trying to get help or do something else. So, you know, these arguments that we need to catch people in their drug use because it's a public safety issue or because we want to make sure that they're not going to exploit these services really takes a very pessimistic view of people, but it also perpetuates a lot, like a pessimistic view that people can't be trusted to tell you if they need help or ask for help. But also it perpetuates stigma against drug use as if it's something that someone needs to be caught for rather than potentially maybe an unmet treatment need or someone who, you know, used on occasion but just happened to test positive today.
So what would it look like if drug testing in these various situations that you've mentioned, if it were to be reduced or eliminated? Are there other mechanisms that could better address what current drug testing practices say they do?
Yeah, I mean, I think if someone shows up to a job interview, they seem to be a fit for your organization, have the skills you need, if their references check out, if they have the experience that you need, to employ them in good faith and to trust that if there are issues that may emerge around a variety of issues that sometimes happen in people's lives, that they would be open to connecting with support and treatment if they need it. And that hopefully if you pay a living wage and give them access to insurance, that would facilitate their ability to get that kind of help. But, you know, just taking people on their word that they're ready and available and willing to work at your workplace and have something to offer because they clearly made it through all of the other checkpoints for employment. And I think when it comes to parents and drug testing parents, I mean, there is no medical benefit to drug testing parents during pregnancy or at the end of pregnancy after giving birth. If you could actually develop a good rapport with your patients, they may be more likely to tell you if they're struggling or if they need help. But also, the use of drug testing without someone's consent doesn't give them an opportunity to start the conversation with you. It's almost like you don't trust them to seek help. And it doesn't encourage you to reflect on why it is that maybe your client or your patient doesn't feel comfortable talking to you about it and how you might want to build more of a relationship so they can ask you for help.
So if listeners are interested in your work at the Drug Policy Alliance or the new project Uprooting the Drug War, how can they learn more? What actions would you suggest?
So they can learn more about the Uprooting the Drug War project by going to uprootingthedrugwar.org, where they can download any of our 6 reports that are part of the series in which we show the different ways that the drug war has taken root in various systems in our lives. And if they want to learn more about the Drug Policy Alliance, they can just look for drugpolicy.org.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it. That was Dr. Sheila Vicaria with the Drug Policy Alliance speaking with me about drug testing and the myths that accompany it. Find links related to this story on our website, kbu.fm/evening news. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.